Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Ask Your Industry Podcast, episode 74. For those of you new to the show, I'm comedian Simon Kane, and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, the live circuit. Toby Haddock is a comedian based in Manchester who has been performing for more than 20 years. He started on a whim by chance and then founded a comedy club called Excess Malarkey, which The Guardian has described as a great example of how a club should be run. 20 years later, that club still runs on a weekly basis, and he is still involved, as well as running the New Material Nights at the Manchester Comedy Store, and is the regular MC at the 99 Club in London, as well as many other credits outside of straight stand-up, including writing, podcasting, acting, and voiceover work. I got him on to talk about a Manchester scene, as well as how to build an audience using podcasting, and how he found his voice in comedy. I think this podcast would be good for any newer comedians interested in how the circuit has evolved, or a local fan of comedy in Manchester who want to know more about the behind the scenes of their favourite clubs, or even someone who is thinking about starting a podcast and isn't sure if it's for them. On a personal note, I'd like to say that if you are looking at starting a podcast, you should just do a pilot that you're never planning on releasing, and that will tell you more about if your idea has any legs, or if you're going to get bored of it, than any bit of advice you're going to get from anyone. This podcast goes live on the 17th of February 2017, and tomorrow, the 18th of February 2017, I am hosting our third live Q&A podcast in Leicester. If you can make it, please do, because it's super important that we get good numbers in order to come back next year. Last year's one went amazingly well, and also it stops me looking insane to the guests who I seem to have cohered into coming into a room where it's just me that they're going to be talking to. The panel is with four Midlands promoters who are going to be talking about the scene, the circuit, and taking your questions live. So please come with questions if you want to ask anything, or email me /give them to me before we start, and I will make sure that I try and get through as many of them as possible during the hour podcast recording. If you're still around, on Sunday the 19th of February 2017, I'm doing my work in progress show at the Leicester Comedy Festival, which is called Laughter is the Best Placebo, and it's at the Exchange at 9 p.m. Both shows are free /donate what you want on the way out. So if you could support me in either of those things, that would be amazing. If you can't make it, please do pass on the information to someone you think can. Thank you very much for any and all help there. Anyway, if you're new here, please hit that subscribe button. So if you're old here, please think about giving us an honest review in iTunes. And either way, please join the Facebook group, which is called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, of course. Without any more delays, this is Toby Haddock.
I started a night called Excess Malarkey in Manchester, which will be 20 years ago this September. September 2017 will be its 20th anniversary. And I had no ambitions to start a comedy club. I was a sort of jobbing, you know, paid 15 maybe level comic, you know, doing it now and again. And my brother-in-law played in a pub in a band, in an Irish band, at a pub called Scruffy Murphy's. Of course it was. And Scruffy Murphy's wanted to do a comedy night called Murphy's Malarkey. The landlord said to my brother-in-law, "I want to do a comedy night." My brother-in-law went, "Oh, I know a comedian." And that was me. And I went down and I met this guy, and he wanted to do it, and he wanted to do it properly. He had a sort of budget. He wanted to not charge, though. So the budget basically paid for the headline act, everything else had to do it for free. And I figured, well, you know, that's okay, it'd be good practice for me. And it might last for 8 weeks. And that was the original plan. Take us up to Christmas, whatever it was. Maybe it was a bit more than 8 weeks. But for some reason, I think I thought it would last 8 to 10 weeks. That, and then we'd review it. And we reviewed it after 8 to 10 weeks or whatever. And I said, well, I'd love to carry on, but I'd love to charge. Because the problem is we have people sort of just wandering in. So we charged 50p. And that was the making of the club. Because everybody who paid 50p looked at the stage. So all they did, they looked to see what they were paying for. About 4 weeks in, I'd said every joke I'd ever said as a comedian and had to go on. And I'm quite lazy. So instead of spending that day writing what I'd do that night, which anybody who's run out of material would sensibly do, I went on stage not quite knowing what I was doing and came off 15 minutes later having got away with it. And I've largely done that every Tuesday ever since. And so I had no ambition. I think the reason I've done okay is because, well, I've done better as a comic than as an actor. I've great ambitions as an actor. It's what I've always wanted to do, and I've kept doing that, you know, next to being a comic. With a comic, I had no ambition, because I didn't. I looked at really good comics and didn't think I could necessarily do that, I guess. I just sort of muddled along, and because I muddled along with no expectation, similarly with the club, I muddled along, and I just thought, well, so long as the people in tonight come next week, I've done okay. And the two things that would make the people who came tonight come next week is if the acts are all good, but not necessarily good as in, you know, Barnstormers on a Friday, Saturday night, because it's Tuesday, it's slightly different. If everybody's got something about them, but also for the acts, if they have the best chance of doing what they do without having to change what they do because they think the audience wants something else. So therefore, I was quite, as a compere, I was quite harsh in those early days. It had to be, don't have to be now because we've got a regular audience, been coming for so long. But in those days, I was quite harsh, and I remember kicking groups of 8 or 9 or 10 out and giving them their money back and going, go, I'll give you your money back, go, because I want these people to have a good evening and I want these people to come back. And that's sort of what happened. And it just sort of snowballed. And we had a peak, you know, where for 3, 4, 5 years we were selling out every week. The comedy circuit has changed since then. But we've still kept our head above water. It's run on a non-profit making model, so I don't expect to take anything out of it. We occasionally put a little bit aside if we have a particularly good night that usually goes on a new cable or something like that. But it's not a money making thing, but it's rewarded me in a lot of other different ways.
Why was it not for profit? Was it just because you had no ambition anyway, so it didn't?
Well, I coined the phrase not for profit after many years of not making any money out of it, and so would sort of say at the end of the night, look, the reason this is a good night is because you don't pay very much. Even now, they pay £3 for members and £5 for non-members. Back in the day, I remember having one bill that was, I think it was £1, and it was Dom Carroll, Kevin Gildee, Peter Kay, 3 headliners for £1, boom. And I just remember at the end of one night sort of going, look, the reason is, it's, you know, we don't make a profit. We're not, that was never part of the deal. That was never part of what I sort of set out to do. For me, it was all about stage time and things like that. And as it went on, you know, I'm fortunate, I do lots of other things, and I've got this sort of mosaic of a CV that earns me a living. So if it means that sometimes I have to give excess £30 to cover the act's bills, and sometimes I might get £50 that I can take home with me sometimes, but invariably it's fairly, because I have guys who work on the door who aren't waged either, but if we do well they get a bit, and if we don't I apologize and they go, that's not what we do it for. So if there is money to go, it goes on, you know, the guys who do the door and the tech and all that sort of thing, but we have a fairly flexible arrangement. So it wasn't intended to be not for profit, but that's one of the glorious side effects of it, and a testament to my business acumen.
Well, the you mentioned that the circuit has changed since you started, as it would have done over 20 years.
Yeah.
Why do you, I mean, you mentioned before we started, why do you think it do you think it would be possible to start a night like that now, or do you think the way the circuit has changed?
Well, not unless we've done something terribly wrong. As I say, we do okay. We on a Tuesday night we regularly get, you know, 60, 70 plus. Sometimes, you know, we've got 120s, 30s, and sometimes even the 200s if we have a special guest. We regularly did 150. Every Tuesday, when we're in Fallowfield, which then was a very student area next to a very busy student halls of residence. Now, we stayed in Fallowfield for a while after that peak, and I thought maybe we'd done something wrong. But I noticed the students in the halls of residence, for example, where at one point we were directly opposite them, they left when I did. I left the club at 11 o'clock to go home. They left their halls of residence at 11 o'clock with bottles of Wicked and what have you to get on the bus to go into town. So what students, who were a big part of our audience, were doing was entertaining themselves at home, i.e. on YouTube, the internet, whatever, for free, getting supermarket booze, which is cheaper than buying pub booze, and then at 11 o'clock going out with enough money in their pocket to get the cheaper shots or whatever, where to those places where people are drunk enough to maybe have sex with each other. That's me psychoanalyzing students, but I think it's a reasonable one. So I think that demographic was sort of slightly watered down. We moved venues a couple of times because venues got closed down. It's amazing how quickly people say, oh, I used to love that club of yours. I go, it hasn't gone anywhere, because newspaper coverage is very good at going, that club has lost its home. It's not then very good at going, but it's all right, it's here now. So you have to battle against things like that. But nonetheless, I think even if we'd stayed in the same place, you know, the internet is such that if you desperately want to find out where excess malarkey is and if it's still happening, you only have to type two words. And I think I see lots of places also, you know, midweek. I sometimes worry and go, God, we're not, you know, in our heyday. And then I go to other places and go, oh no, you know, it is tough. And some big clubs at weekends. I remember talking to somebody who was in charge of a big club, and this was on the Monday, and they said, we haven't sold any tickets for Saturday. Now, they have a slightly different business model. They'll paper it. They take the bar money, all of that sort of thing. Slightly different. They have an infrastructure. I don't. I work on a night-by-night basis. I have a budget for the night, which is also dependent on footfall. I have to factor in the footfall to pay the amount I spend on the acts. And sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't. But either way, I've still got to pay for it all on that night. And I don't get anything to do with bar sales or any of that sort of business. And I think I look back and I think I didn't realise at the time how we did a good job. The club was great, but it was also great because it was so busy and people would get turned away. And of course, if people get turned away, that means they come down early next time. And I think it was just a time pre the big internet boom. I mean, this was a time when, you know, I used to have to go to a photocopier to photocopy the posters onto big luminous A3 posters because I thought that's what would get the extra people in. You know, I don't even bother with that sort of thing now. It's all about the internet. It's all about mailing lists and visibility and Twitter and Facebook. It's totally different. But also, I think there is a less of an appetite for live stuff because people watch stuff for free in the same way that I used to be a telly addict. You know, I would video whatever was on the telly at night if I was gigging and that sort of thing. Now, I mean, I don't watch terrestrial television. If there's something I fancy, I might pick it up later on iPlayer. But our viewing and consumer habits have totally changed.
To say that there's less of an appetite for live, are you speaking specifically about Manchester or are you speaking nationally?
Interesting, because I mean, I've been a regular MC at the 99 Club in Leicester Square, which has a great footfall, but that's a very touristy area. And that's not a club like most clubs that I know that has a sort of regular clientele, or at least a semi-regular clientele, because it's in the heart of Leicester Square. It's a slightly different thing. That always does very well. But we're still talking, you know, 70, 80, 90 people on a Wednesday. So actually the fact that excess in a sort of much less footfally area of Manchester is getting the same on a Tuesday shows that we're doing well. And the 99 Club is a great club. So I don't know about the London thing. I mean, I certainly know that some gigs that I used to play aren't there anymore, and some gigs that I do play are quieter. And I mean, I remember when Jonglers Camden, as was big and buzzing, and I also remember when it was, you know, three tables and 20 squaddies on Groupon, you know. So, but I think it's a general trend that people don't see live entertainment as necessarily first protocol. Also, I think there's a small number of very visible comedians on things like 8 out of 10 Cats and Mock the Week, and those who have a profile accorded to them by their television appearances, who then tour. And if you've got a comedy budget for the year as a punter, you might go, well, I'll go and see that person who I know, even though tickets for that are slightly more expensive than my local comedy club, because I know what I'm getting and I know I like that person. That's reasonable. So people are maybe a bit more, especially in times of economic trouble, are a bit more conservative with their spend, in that they'd rather spend a little more on something they know rather than spend once or twice than spend a little less four or five times on a blank, as far as they're concerned, a blank canvas.
What's really interesting for me about that is I've done a lot of promoter interviews in London, partly because I lived there and it was easy for me. And this is my attempt to branch out and do it in different cities to find out what people think. And whenever I've spoken to someone who isn't a London promoter as such, and I've asked them what they think of their city versus nationally, they automatically compare it to London. And I find it interesting that that's... Because obviously the industry from an outsider point of view, and certainly from an insider point of view to an extent, is very London-centric. But do you kind of model what you're doing then on London stuff? Or do you...
I think... And in fact, I think I was quite surprised when I started working in London, which I don't do an awful lot, because to be perfectly honest, not really worth it for me. And even when I did actually live in London for a short while, when I got married, one of my other non-profit making exercises, and I still found myself gigging mostly in the Northwest. I mean, I had roots here, mates here, kids here, that sort of thing, because actually the London gigs aren't as well paid. They pay you for a weekend in Manchester, I think, based on the idea that you've come from London, so we'll need somewhere to, you know, need to drive there, we need somewhere to stay, blah, 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 and that's all sort of factored in. Whereas if you live down the road in Chorlton, as I do, you're getting paid the same as an act from London, but you're not having to factor in all of those extra things. So I think wages here in Manchester are set to sort of lure people from the London base, and unless you're doubling up in London, the wages for gigs are actually not that great. I also found, and I still, this, which is why I'm a very strong advocate of the Manchester circuit, which I think is great, and for the first 10 years of my career, I'm not a driver, I existed purely on doing gigs that I could get to from Manchester by public transport. So, you know, Manchester, Liverpool, Sheffield, and I was gigging every night of the week. You know, sometimes it would be a pub up in Withington, I'd headline for 30 quid. That gave me experience of doing longer sets, and 30 quid's not bad for a Monday night, and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, say Comparing the Frog at the weekend, or Baby Blue in Liverpool, or Last Laugh in Sheffield, and then they have their satellite gigs as well, but I was gigging all the time. And I didn't feel the need to do London. And when I did London, which I thought would be this great sort of Shangri-La that I'd imagine, especially talking like I do and doing the sort of comedy that I do, I thought, you know, I finally have landed. And I found, I didn't find that about that circuit at all. It's nothing wrong with it, but it's but I certainly think that that the circuit here holds its own and has a slightly different character, in that I think there is general progression and there is genuine room for oddballs on more established nights. In London, it strikes me that there are two very distinct circuits, the open spot circuit and the circuit for established acts. That's because London can pick and choose. That's because London can have three headliners on. I do the 99 Club, as I say, every Wednesday, and the bill is always astonishing because nobody's doing much on a Wednesday night. So I'm there with the delightful prospect of, you know, comparing Mike Wilmot, Ed Gamble, Nathan Caton, you know, acts of that quality, bam, 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 Felicity Ward, Bob Mills, Nish Kumar, you know, on a Wednesday night, boom, boom, boom. It's great. It's great for me. I love doing it. Now, I don't think you could sustain those sorts of... At Excess Malarkey, for example, you have an opening paid 20, you have a break, you have an open spot, you have a paid 15, you have a break, you have a headliner. Now, I only charge 3 quid, so that's part of that. But I also think that means you get distinct and interesting voices, and because of the nature of the gig as well, because it's not a gig that has to attract passing tourists or big office nights out, you're allowed a mix of styles, you're allowed a bit of nuance, and sometimes the oddball open spot that breezes in from nowhere is the best act of the night because it's a surprise, and that surprise sort of reverberates around the building, and some of the guys who are a bit more experienced and a bit more dyed in the wool seem a little bit staid actually compared to that. Now, on a difficult, testy, heady Friday night, such things are not quite the same, and you need the steady pair of hands who needs to keep the boat steady, and the vagaries of the open spot from left field are exposed, you know, to more scrutiny or a different kind of scrutiny. But I think this, so I've never tried to aspire to be like anything else. I grew up, as it were, in the Manchester circuit with what I saw around me, which was I got my experience on bills that when I was starting out had Chris Addison, Dave Gorman, Carolina Hearn. She'd just sort of moved up really and was doing the telly. But Tony Burgess, you know, really struck. Lucy Porter, Johnny Vegas, Peter Kay. You know, Peter Kay started actually slightly after I did, but ascended fairly quickly. And you were on bills with those people, and you saw what they did. Sometimes it made you want to give up, and sometimes you'd have a good gig and go, actually, I can hold my own with this. And I think that's an important development, and I think there's less of a them and us. And I always think the Manchester circuit's been pretty good at being supportive, and there are also nights where established acts come and try out new material and consort with there's not so much them and us, I would say. And again, I'm not disparaging the London when I say circuit when I say that. Your question, though, of saying, you know, did you aspire to be like London? No, and I actually think we have some virtues that London doesn't have.
I would completely agree with the sentiment of there being an open circuit and a circuit for established acts, mainly because that is spot on. And it's frustrating for someone at my level in that, you know, I do all right on open spots on the established and nights and stuff, but to break through to doing the paid stuff, they're sort of already like, well, we've got a list as long as our arm with people we can just get on, like you've named a load of them now, and often management and stuff just have enough time to push people through and they do a lot of that for them and stuff. And I mean, I've done spots at the London Comedy Store, and I've done one with you here like a month ago or something, and there's a totally different vibe with both those clubs just within the chain, or at least I found it.
But this is a very different night. New Stuff is a night that I book that there's no guarantee of any progression. It is a forum for established acts to try out new material, but I will also sometimes take a punt on somebody who's maybe not played the store before or not played the store much, and it gives them a chance to acclimatise themselves to the Comedy Store stage. If I can surround them with acts that are established here or that I know, so this isn't a Comedy Store night. If you do really well, they'll refer you to the guys that book the weekends, or maybe you even get referred to London. I don't really know. I'm not part of that infrastructure. What I do is I put on a night here, and they trust me to, and it's gone from one night a month to two nights a month, and it brings in the punters, and it's a good night. But that's all entirely at my discretion. I book the acts. I'm under no pressure to book certain people and not book certain people. The pressure I put myself under is that it has to be a strong night with, as I say, the odd room for manoeuvre. And sometimes I'll just take a chance or play by a hunch. But it's no guarantee of any ascendancy up the Comedy Store ladder, because I don't have that sort of influence.
How did this night come about then? Because it sounds like you run the same, and correct me if I'm wrong, you run a kind of thing like Excess, except for it's like a club rather than in a venue that can be moved around. And it's your kind of booking policy rather than it being, so it feels like it's kind of an outlaw to itself within the club structure of this venue.
Well, it was another accident. They wanted to do a new material night at the Comedy Store. This was many years ago, and it was the height of sort of Excess was doing particularly well, so I was on a bit of it, and I'd started to do a few bits and bobs for the Comedy Store, the Wednesday night topical comedy night that's now doesn't happen anymore. And they said they want to do a new material night, and I said, "Well, look, I'll compare and book it for you." And they went, "No, we don't really need that. It just needs people to sort of pop down, you know, headliners passing through, people come and have a drink, shoot the shit, do 10 minutes. And I was just like, I know comedians, that ain't going to happen. And we sort of talked through it, because it was originally not supposed to have a compare. It was supposed to be one act led on to the other. And that didn't work out. That was never going to happen. So I ended up comparing it and booking it. You know, getting six Comedy Store headline acts every Sunday to do their new material was a tall order. So I cast the net out, and I got very lucky quite early on, because there were, coming up to Edinburgh, Tom Binns, Alan Carr, Jason Manford, a few people who went on to do very well at Edinburgh. One of the reasons they did very well at Edinburgh was because they came here every bloody month and hammered their material. So they went to Edinburgh, you know, lesson to all the Edinburgh acts out there. You know, people don't just turn up with a show. We know that, but they really hammered it, some of those guys. So that suddenly made it easier to get people on. But it's never been what it was envisaged to be, which is Comedy Store weekend acts all coming out. And so I had to, again, use my discretion. There was no way I was going to... I don't have the same booking policy here as I have for Excess Malarkey. I can't. Excess Malarkey is a funny, independent, quirky gig. This is the Comedy Store, which is the standard bearer of, you know, the comedy circuit. You know, I would jeopardise my job here if I didn't take very seriously the name and standing of the Comedy Store. So I have a very different mindset in terms of this night and Excess. But they've always let me get on with booking it. And Don Ward comes along a couple of times a year, checks it out. He really likes the night. And has sometimes seen acts he didn't know, which is great. So whilst I can't offer progression, I'm not denying that it can happen. There's room at the store for the Sunday nights to be a bit, you know, there's the King Gong is one night, Alex Boardman's Young Guns is another night. That's a night that encourages particularly young, developing comics. I think they get a few quid to do a slightly longer set than you'd do at a night like this or the Gong Show. So that's a development night. You know, the idea that the store is a sort of corporate beer moth that isn't interested in the grassroots is wrong. It's one I've heard. It's one I think I probably believed many years ago because I was young and paranoid. And because it's hard to get onto. Well, it should be. It's the Comedy Store. They pay you a fortune at the weekend. And there's a lot of people who are capable of doing that. So it should be hard to play the Comedy Store at a weekend. It's the gig that everybody aspires to do. But they'd be fools if they didn't realise that people had to be nurtured and developed. Nobody lands a fully formed headliner. And I think it's the Sunday nights. And the Gong Show is harsh and it's difficult and it's cruel. But there we go. That's comedy. I'm glad it wasn't such a thing when I started out because I wouldn't have the backbone for that. I muddled along my own way. But I think nights like this and nights like Alex's night are all about nurturing the grassroots. And I actually think it's a great environment here, yeah.
If someone wanted to progress at the Comedy Store, is it only the Gong Show that gets them... like through to that open spot at a normal night?
I've got no idea.
Oh, you don't even... Okay.
I've got my universe of my own terrors to face. I guess so, you know. I think if you do it... there's Alex Boardman's night, but I don't know how you get on that. That's Alex's affair.
Yeah, fair enough. A lot of comedians who do promotion work don't like being seen as promoters. Like, they want to be known as a comedian in their own right, rather than someone that like books a night and also does gigs. Do you find that you've ever been labelled with that brush, given that you started your own night and you book this? And I've been told you're involved in other nights as well. You have been in the past.
Well, I think if one worries about nomenclature, one's worrying about the wrong things. I mean, I do sometimes. I was thinking about this today, actually, when I was painting the stairs. I was just thinking, it's funny, I wonder what people think of me as a comedian, because I've done well as a comedian. I've taken shows to the West End. I compare three of the best clubs in the country. But also my stand-up work has toured internationally. But I still do think most people think, oh, he's that quite eccentric guy who compares that night. And I remember I was at an awards ceremony this year where my play, I've written two plays for Eddie Four, they've both been nominated for the top award. You know, the Chortle didn't even mention that. They mentioned the list of things and then they just put the title of my play. They didn't actually put that I'd written it. And I was like, I can't, don't even get mentioned. And I saw John Bishop, who was there as, you know, famous guest sort of thing. He went, all right, Toby. And John's always been very nice to me and he likes my comedy. I've made him laugh. So, all right, Toby, what are you doing here? And I went, yeah. Wouldn't even cross your mind that I might be here because I've been nominated for an award, you know. And I think that's just me. But then again, that's one, I think, you know, we're all paranoid. And two, I've done better than I ever expected. Well, do I worry about... I don't think anybody should worry about whether people see them as this, that or the other. You've got to largely make your own work in this business anyway. So there's no point bitching or worrying about that sort of thing. Do I think people only see me as a compere and as a promoter? Maybe. I should think what happens most of the time is people don't give me a second thought, just like they don't give you a second thought or anybody else a second thought, because everybody in this business is worried about where their career's going. Or what, you know, I remember a friend of mine doing something well on TV and I thought, why haven't they given me a thing in that? I'm an actor. Why don't they know I'm an actor? Why aren't they? And it took me about a year and I thought, because when I've been making my, say, my radio programmes and sort of thing, I don't sort of have a list of my mates go, oh yes, I must remember to think about Jim, because Jim deserves a break, because Jim's been slogging away for 10 years, and frankly it's my chance to reset the balance in Jim's favour. Just trying to make a radio series, just the fact that loads of people I know have been trying to do their stuff, and the fact that I'm not in the forefront of their mind is not because they're awful or because I'm underrated or anything like that, is because we are all just trying to do the things that we do. It's a business that is, you know, somebody might just forgotten you one day, or it's like when you send an email and you never hear back and you think that person must hate me. I've got tons of emails I've forgotten to reply to. It's not because I hate that person, it's because just as I was about to reply to it, my girlfriend called about the cake in the fridge that I should have thrown away that's now mouldy, and now I've got to throw away the fridge, the thing that's mouldy in the fridge, but I'm annoyed with her because she never did that thing that I wanted her to do, and I'm going to bring that up now because I know I'm in trouble about the cake that was mouldy in the fridge. So instead of just going, yeah, it's my fault the cake was mouldy, I go, it's probably your fault because I would have got rid of the mouldy cake if you'd done that thing I'd asked you to do. And all before you've known it, I've forgotten about that email. That doesn't mean I hate Gary. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, we all hate Gary, to be
fair.
Fuck Gary. No, I completely agree with that. I think being self-involved is the only... This is probably one of the only industries being self-involved is kind of a virtue. Like, it's kind of useful in the sense that you kind of make your own work because you're in your own space.
But I also think it can stop you. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I, you know, maybe used to be grumpy about the Comedy Store, and that was all part of that whole... Because I ran an independent comedy club. It's really difficult to get column inches. We were busy, but I wanted things there going, this is an amazing club. It's won the Chortle Award. And I wanted the local press to do that. I won an award here, and it wasn't even mentioned in City Life. And I'd go, why aren't they mentioning me? They should be championing me, blah, 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 blah. And I had this sort of, and I was a fist, oh, I was so angry and all that sort of thing. And I learned that things were much better when I wasn't angry, and when, again, I realised that sometimes people just neglected to put a thing because they forgot, or maybe because they were crap at their job, or maybe because they didn't care. And that actually having, in terms of this place, the Comedy Store, having a comedy store in Manchester was brilliant for comedy because it actually helped... sort of spread the word that we already knew that there was a brilliant circuit here and brilliant comics on your doorstep. And actually, when I pulled my head out of my arse and realised it wasn't all a battle, I've got friends now who are younger than me, who are a couple who've had really good breaks, who one of whom went to a casting recently, and they were actually the wrong demographic and they shouldn't have done the thing, and they texted me and said, I'm gonna tear them off a strip because this is a complete waste of my time, and I'm pissed off. I went, don't do that, you're about to see one of the top casting directors in the country. It's not a battle. It's not, although if you're pissed off when you go in, they'll just go, well, I won't see you there again. Whereas if you go in and you're nice, you might not get this job, but they might go, ah, oh, but 2 weeks later when it's this job. Well, they won't if they think you're a dick. And I think maybe it's because I'm 42 and I've got two kids and I'm a bit tired that I'm much less furious than I used to be. But I don't think I did myself any favours being furious, because I wasted a lot of energy worrying about injustice. Who said the world is fair? Great quote from an actor I knew called Ray Lunnan, who's no longer with us. I wrote his obituary for The Guardian, and then I read his obituary in The Independent, which was better than the one I wrote in The Guardian. And it had a quote from him where it said, and he said, I've never complained about the business. And he had a great career. I've never complained about the business because when I started, nobody told me it would be fair. And I thought that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say. Who said it's going to be fair? Don't waste your energy wanting it to be fair. There's not somebody there who, if you shout loud enough, is going to go, oh yes, I'm sorry, the balance isn't tipped in the favour of the virtuous. I better just sort that out. It's you know, that's the business. Either do something about it or be furious about it. And you could do something about it and it might not work. But it's certainly not going to work if you just sit there bitching about it.
No, I had quite a, I wouldn't say a row, but I had quite a bad argument with someone recently because they put a thing on Facebook saying they'd got an agent, and like people had messaged them saying, oh, how did you get your agent? And they said, I worked really hard and it led to this. And I was like, yeah, but you're saying that like working hard guarantees you're going to get an agent. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't. It just means you worked hard, so statistically you are more likely to get noticed by an agent. You can't write it like, I worked hard, so of course I got an agent. Because first of all, not everyone wants an agent. And second of all, how can you can't tell people that, because it's going to make everyone think, I'll just work hard and it'll all be sorted when an agent comes along. And a lot of the time, people's first agent isn't the best thing for them anyway.
No, and you know, you think you're getting, and I used to think, oh, it's just because my agents are useless, this is particularly acting agents. And actually, you then meet other actors who are with that agency that you really want to get in with, and they go, God, no, they're useless. I go, but you were in that. And they go, well, yeah, I was only in that because the director of that worked with me on that, and I did that. You know, a good agent does make a difference in, if we're talking the very top flight. But even a lot of those top flight agents, they can't get you the job. Mm. You have to get the job.
you have to be what they want, essentially. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of things, especially on the open circuit in London, and I suppose it's less so, but it's still there a little bit in the way that you mentioned there, where if people are nice, they're more likely to want to work with you, where people will start nights to trade spots, or they'll become promoters, and they'll work out a way that means that it works out beneficial for them. And I assume that's obviously impossible for you to do here, because it's not like it's such a stringent but laxed policy that means that you couldn't sort of, you know what I mean, it would look weird if you started booking people based on trading spots for yourself. But have you ever lost out on gigs as a result of just not being able to book someone as regularly as you, because they're a mate here, kind of thing, or anything like that?
I don't think so, because I don't sort of think about losing out on gigs, because my career's largely spent having to cancel stuff because something else has come up. Have I lost gigs? Well, there's maybe a couple of clubs I don't work for because maybe the promoters of that didn't prosper at excess in the early years, often largely because I forgot to phone people back, if I'm honest. But none that I'm kicking myself about, and none that I couldn't have done something about if I'd really tried and been that bothered.
Okay, let's do this then. Say someone emails in to get a spot at, you obviously don't book there anymore, but excess or the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
What is it like at your end working on lineups and things like that? So someone can get in the mind of the other end of the email, instead of them just hitting send and going, oh, I bet they don't get back to me, or oh, they didn't get back to me, it's not that problem.
I can tell a cut and pasted email, and they don't terribly excite me, if I'm honest. I feel slightly less guilty about not replying to those. But quite often I just forget. What I try and do is, if I open one and it's one I've got to respond to later, I'll then mark it as unread, and it'll go on my thing to do. I've just done a backlog of about 50 emails that I knew were all about this night next year, say, and I've got back to people. You know, somebody in October said, can I do January the 29th, and they emailed that on October the 12th, and they found out yesterday that yes, they can. To pique my interest, because I can't really take many risks here, as I say, I sometimes do if somebody sends me a funny clip, or if somebody comes across, to be perfectly honest, as professional. If I get one that's riddled with spare, the ones I get, Toby, somebody says you run a comedy night or something at the store. I've literally had one that said that. You run a new material night or summer at the store. How do I get on that? Not that way, sweetheart. I'm an old fashioned. I'm a student of old actors, and I'm a big fan of old 60s, 70s television, when people used to write proper letters to people saying, we would like to offer you the part of Bragan in 6 episodes of Doctor Who. Oh, I would be delighted to take the part. And then after, it was such an enjoyable engagement. I look forward to working with you again. And when people used to write letters, and you'd find out whether you'd got a job or not. Remember one actress telling me that a director took her out to dinner to explain to her why he hadn't given her a particular television part that she'd auditioned for. Now you just don't find out. So a bit of a sort of well-worded professional look. If you come across to me as professional on the email, I suspect you're more likely to come across as professional on the stage, which is going to help you get onto the Comedy Store stage in particular. With excess, I would say don't email me. I'd say email Ros Bell or Corrie Shaw, because they're much better organised than I am. Though Corrie's off at the moment, so don't bother her. And I think Ros is busy. Leave them alone till after Christmas.
If you're listening to this in January, go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that particularly about excess, because I've got 3 books I'm supposed to finish writing this year. With new stuff, it's more likely if I've seen you. If somebody comes to excess and does a really good job, this guy called Ben Pope, who I saw recently, absolutely brilliant. I said, well, you've got to come to the store. And I had faith that he would come here and he would do well, and he really did. He blasted it. That's really exciting, because I go, that's the progression. Somebody's come to it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Access that I didn't know from Adam, has just done this spot, just been booked in for this spot by Ros O'Curry to do the 10 or the 15 or whatever. I think he did the 10, open spot. But it was great. And he came and did it, and he was sandwiched in between more experienced acts. He absolutely blew the night away. It's absolutely fantastic. And you go, okay, well, I'll make sure. Ben, you email me. Let's get you back in. You do it like that. So, yeah, be good in my vicinity.
Yeah, makes sense. Don't be good where I can't see you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fair enough.
But, you know, dude, I mean, if you've got a clip or something, but, you know, it's with this night, I have to be careful how I take a punt. Better to be good in my vicinity. Especially if you send me the clip I'm on a train and I've got limited gigabytes, whatever they're called, left on my plan this month. I'll do that later and then I'll forget.
So, if you didn't want to book someone, would you tell them, sorry, we don't take that kind of act, or I can't book that kind of act? Or is it a case of just keep emailing in?
If I don't want to book someone.
If you couldn't or you didn't want to book someone for this particular gig, or any gig that you are involved in.
No, I've said, I've got a bit better at it recently. I've sort of said, look, I'm not really in a position because this is how the gig is envisaged. This is the sort of person that we usually have on. You know, when somebody says, oh, I've been gigging for 14 months now or whatever, and I sort of go, oh, you probably need to have a bit more under your belt. And that's not to patronise people, but that's just because that's, you know. I feel then people are maybe trying to leapfrog over the gong. We're not an alternative for the gong for people who don't want to do it.
Right.
Just because I might be slightly soft on occasion. That's not the deal. I'm not sure what the deal is, but it's in my bones.
Fair enough. You've talked a little bit, but not really said it as such, in that the circuit is kind of, well, there's sort of been an ongoing discussion about whether the circuit is in crisis or not. And for you to say, as a booker in this capacity anyway, that less people are coming to live shows, or there's less demand for that, would you say that's still a problem, especially in Manchester?
I hope that things go round and round in circles. When I was starting out, there were plenty of smug white middle-class men doing comedy. There weren't any earthy northerners with a cheeky smile until a chap called Peter Kay came along, and nobody thought there was a gap in the market for him. I mean, he was brilliant at what he did as well, but he came out and provided something people didn't know that they were missing. And that came out of nowhere. At the moment, nobody seems to be missing live comedy. That doesn't mean they never will. That doesn't mean that in, you know, nothing dates like new technology. People, nothing bores quicker people than, you know, today's latest fad. And so who know? You know, people still go and see live music. People still go to the theatre. And I think stand-up's a great night out. There's nothing like the febrile atmosphere of a live comedy night. I'm saddened that there aren't the small, funny little gigs that were all over the place when I started. Although I've seen a few more of those spring up lately. I think something needed to be done about some of the terrible gigs anyway, because I think they send out the signal to people that this is what comedy is like, and it isn't. And I think most of the weekend gigs that survive now are excellent. Yes, you know, especially the independents or the ones that, you know, the big standard bearers. Like this. I mean, you look at the Comedy Store London's lineup or Manchester, every Friday and Saturday night. You go, God, the circuit is in really good health. But there are more comics and there are fewer spots. And it also saddens me a little bit that means that the circuit doesn't quite have as many of the eccentric slightly out there performers that it once had. I mean, you do one of the Raw nights at the Frog and Bucket back in the day, and it was a menagerie of weirdos. And I don't mean that pejoratively, even though it sounds. I mean, it was, you know, it was a really, it could, and the audience were kind of fine with that. I think comedy became very professional in the course of my 21 years this week since I did my first ever gig.
Congratulations.
Which means I'm a survivor. That's, do you know what? I actually carry that. It surprises me with a certain amount of pride. For somebody that said at the beginning of this interview, I didn't really have any ambition to be a stand-up. That's not quite true. I didn't think I would be able enough. And I certainly didn't think, you know, I'd watch the Comedy Store Players and spoken with Hallowed Tones. Well, when the Comedy Store came to Manchester, I thought, well, that's nice, but I didn't think I'd ever play there. And my picture went up on the wall this week. So I think that shows that anything is possible. And it took me a while, it took me a long while to find my voice. 10 years at least, and that was a gigging every Tuesday as well, to find that I didn't have to pretend to be this angry person, because I was that on stage as well as off. And when you settle into your own voice, and then you can just sort of know that you can just go on and talk about whatever you want. That's the breakthrough. Sometimes it took me a long time. So there's a lot of comics. There are fewer spaces. I'm not the best person to ask, because I'm fortunate in that I have other things that I do. So that where somebody who only earns his or her money from comedy has to maybe go to Southampton on a Thursday night for 120 quid, I'm fortunate that I am in a position to go, I don't need to do that. But I've certainly found those years where I was easily gigging every weekend if I wanted to. If I wasn't, I'd pick something up and all those sorts of things. Those days have gone, and I see lots of very good. And also, I know now, it used to be that if you pulled a Friday night on the Monday, people would pull their hair out. What the hell? What? How are we ever going to fill that? Now you could pull the Friday night on. You could text round good acts. Go, you doing anything Friday? I'm going to have to pull a gig. I've got a bit of TV warm up or something, and you'll have a taker. So I know it's not just me. And as I say, because I'm a little bit choosy, but I think nature abhors a vacuum, and I think there's enough talent on the circuit, not just in terms of talent on stage, but talent as in terms of acumen and creativity and all that sort of thing, that people can create audiences. I did a series of plays in Manchester around the corner from here about a month and a half ago, new short 15-minute plays written by established TV writers with local actors. And it was on every day for 2 weeks in a venue that seats about 169 people, and it sold out every night. Because it's got some really bright, smart, dedicated people. That's been going 16 seasons now, so about 8 years. It's called JB Shorts. It shows that, you know, I think the circuit got a bit complacent as well. I think it was a license to print money for a bit, for certainly some of the bigger clubs. And now you have to be a bit more creative about how you get people in. But I still think it can be done.
Okay. I've got one more question about promoting stuff before we go into other things you do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk of diversity on the circuit, like you've mentioned. And obviously there's things about quotas, both on TV and in radio to a certain degree, and sort of making sure there is enough, as you mentioned, you know, not just a white middle-class male lineup on bills and stuff.
Yeah.
How much does that come into your makeup and mind when you're putting together bills?
Not one iota. In fact, funny enough, we had a bill at Excess about 8 weeks ago that was all female. It wasn't a ladies' night or anything like that. It was just Roz had booked somebody, Corey booked somebody, I'd booked somebody, and oh, it's all women. So then, of course, I kept going, oh, this is brilliant, because it's an all-female gig. And we haven't mentioned that in any of the publicity. It was just a thing that happened. You know, we haven't made a big deal of it. And Roz said at the end of that, you really did make a big deal of that. You mentioned it every single time. I went, oh, damn, but it was good because we didn't make a deal of it until you did make a big deal of it. But and that happened again recently. I think we had 3 women and 4 men. But that was because I don't balance a bill particularly. You know, you stick on who's available and who, you know, if you've booked in somebody, you don't want to then, because you've got another woman, ring that first book, go, oh, can you do the following week? Because I don't want 2 women on. That's ridiculous. So if it falls like that, it falls like that. I have been a victim of quotas, and I bet you now expect me to go, oh, it's political correctness gone mad. I'm not going to. Twice I've had television parts that I have either been promised or that I've actually, in one case, been given, taken away, and I've been replaced by an actor of colour. Different excuses both times, outcome the same. And in fact, one of them was a part that had been written for me in something. It wasn't much of a part, but it was a, the name was an in-joke. It would have been a funny little thing. It would have been a part on telly for me. It would have been nice. And the message came back when I sent a thing saying, aren't we supposed to be filming that soon? And the message came back saying, yeah, I'm sorry about that, but they saw, you know, the big bosses saw, you know, the cast lists and said that it wasn't diverse enough and your part is now being played by a black woman. And I sent a text back saying, that's the story of my life, mate, in which I will be played by Whoopi Goldberg. There have been countless black, Asian, gay, whatever people who have lost out on work in this business because of an unfair bias the other way. If I lose out on two small parts on television to slightly redress that balance, I think it's a bit pathetic of me to bitch about it. And I refer you to what Ray Lunnan said. Nobody ever told me it was going to be fair. And what's fair anyway? Because I always think, but what about those two people who got that job? They'll have been absolutely delighted, and it might have been a part that they wouldn't normally have got considered for, because unless this sort of thing has started to happen. Now, so I think you have to have a slightly more... I certainly don't believe in giving a job to somebody who is not good enough at that job based on their ethnicity or whatever. But there's loads of good comics out there, and there's loads of good actors out there. And none of us have a God-given right to be any of the... given any of the things that we get. And again, if it just slightly redresses the balance and normalizes something that in everyday society is normal but isn't reflected on our television sets or in our dramas or in our comedy, or is so only in a certain way, you know, something does need to be done. But in terms of the way I book live comedy and that sort of thing, that doesn't enter my head at all. I could accidentally have an all black bill, but I will question that in no way. But nor would actually, and this is the more telling, nor would I question it if everyone was white male and middle class. And I suspect I've booked a hell of a lot more of those nights in my time,
just on the numbers of the people that are there. So you have said a few times that you always wanted to be an actor. That's kind of your thing. So if I said to you, how would you describe yourself as a career? Like, if you had to pick one job title, would you say actor?
No, because I earn my living as a stand-up comedian.
Okay. So if you had to get one label, it wouldn't be promoter or actor, it would be comedian.
If I was honest, yeah.
By the sounds of it, that would reflect then in your... because some people are comedians, but want to be writers, for example, and obviously make more money on the live circuit than they do from their writing work, or vice versa.
Hmm.
Does your earnings reflect what you think you are then?
Well, probably, although that's slightly changed now because I've just got because I haven't mentioned writing, and I've had a number of very healthy writing commissions, none of which I've chased. My uncle's wanted to write all his life. He's a film editor and a very successful and able one, but he's always wanted to write a play for Radio 4. I've never particularly aimed to write a play for Radio 4, but love the idea. And I wrote one last year, and I've just been commissioned to write one for next year. And that's fallen into my lap comparatively easy. So that just goes to show. I mean, it's a moot question, because I say I'm an actor, writer and comedian. And I say it in that order because I think it sounds better. And actually, I do well as an actor. I do a lot of voiceovers. In fact, I wonder if he broke down my earnings if I actually earned more as a voiceover artist. I do a lot of plays for Radio 4. I present on Radio 4 Extra. My voice has stood me in good stead. I don't know why my mum always said I should. Anyway, my voice has helped me. I think I'm relatively recently I managed to go, actually, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm a comedian, because I've always done myself down anyway. So I think that, oh, well, you'll never be good enough to be a comedian. You know, you're just the promoter, the compere or whatever, you'll never be good enough to play the Comedy Store. Well, I've always felt I've never been good enough for anything, and that's what's sort of driven me on to do stuff. So I'm proud to call myself a comedian, because I see it for me as somebody who doesn't walk into a room and dazzle it, and who doesn't sit round a table and be very, very funny, and who looks at some comedians and think they make it look easy. The fact that I've managed to earn a living doing it, the fact that I'm still doing it 21 years later, and the fact that I play the Comedy Store, I've been to the West End and do all those things, even if some people do only see me as a promoter, I know that I've done, when I look at it and go, oh, actually, I'm quite proud of that, because I'm not a Seymour Mace. I always use Seymour as an example. Seymour's an obviously funny guy. Seymour is funny. Seymour is funny bones. He's a comedic weird. He's funny. just funny, like Eric Morecambe. It's just, you look at him, he's funny. You don't look at me and I'm funny. But I've managed to do it, and I've managed to do it to a very high level. I've closed the Comedy Store, and nobody afterwards went, well, you shouldn't have done that. So I'm proud to call myself a comedian. That's only on a very personal level, based on maybe limitations I'd thought about myself. But there's a lot I look back on myself 15, 20 years ago and go, well, you were wrong about that. And that's okay. I'm okay with that as well.
So when you were starting out, when you were going to start out as a comedian, was that reflective of the fact that there weren't many people, quote-unquote, like you high up, which meant that you maybe thought it wasn't an aspirational thing?
No, there were loads of people like me high up. I just didn't think I'd be as good as them. There were loads of smug, white, middle-class men doing political jokes, which is how I started out. Now I just do jokes about falling apart, crumbling, and being cross about trivia. So when I started talking about Doctor Who, I took a big turn, actually. No! A friend of mine put a comedy night on, said, did I want to go? I had to go. Friends, loads of friends of mine came along to support me. They laughed, as did some of the other people. It felt good. I thought, I'll do that again. And yeah. 21 years ago later, here we are in the cellar of the Comedy Store.
That's pretty much what's happened to me. I did it once, found I enjoyed it more than anything, and now I just carry on trying to get that back. So, it's just interesting how your career's sort of taken different turns in that way. And you mentioned Doctor Who. I was going to tell you very quickly this story, and I said I'd do it on this just because it's easier. But do you know Pete Dillon Trenchard?
Yeah.
A little bit? Right. I texted him last year because I saw there was a Doctor Who special at Christmas.
Yeah.
Just to tell him that I'd seen there was Doctor Who Christmas special at Christmas. And he replied, because I thought he might not want to miss it, and he replied, they do it every year? Like, that's not a new thing. And because I didn't know anything about Doctor Who and I've never watched an episode of it, I thought, oh, I'm helping a mate out. That's the level you're looking at here, by the way. So if I say anything ignorant and you don't understand the Doctor Who references...
Sure thing.
That's why. And in fact, you recently helped me out because I was mistaken for another character in Doctor Who.
Yes.
Which I still love.
Yeah.
Because he's dead.
Yeah. So well, we think he is.
Okay. Well, I did some Googling after you told me that and I couldn't. You run a Doctor Who podcast.
Well, that was another thing that happened by accident and is non-profit making. This is how my life...
What do you make profit on?
I write obituaries for The Guardian. I do voiceovers. And I play the Comedy Store. And I spend all my... it's on non-profit making. Vanity project. Doctor Who was about to celebrate its 50th anniversary in 2013. My marriage was breaking up and I'd been very ill in hospital. And so was consequently rather down in the dumps at my mum's house, feeling like I had nowhere to go, nothing to do. It was about to be Doctor Who's 50th anniversary, which is supposed to be the most exciting time of my life, and I wanted to kill myself. Somebody on Twitter put, my wish for Doctor Who's 50th anniversary is that Toby Haydoke interviews everyone from Doctor Who, because I'd done a few Doctor Who DVD extras where I'd tracked down some... I'd found out what had happened to some people nobody knew anything about, blah-de-blah-de-blah. I'd been a bit of an archaeologist of people. And I said, well, I can't interview everyone from Doctor Who. And I don't know why I thought this when I put it, but I just thought, what I could do is I could try and get, just as a task, just give me something to do, I could get a first-hand anecdote from every single Doctor Who story. Spend the 50th year doing that as a podcast. I always really thought, well, I know so-and-so who was in the whole of the Patrick Troughton era, so that'll knock all them off, blah, blah, blah. I thought it'd be fairly easy. And I approached this company and I said, how about it, Big Finish, who are this company that do Doctor Who audios, but they have web space and they do a podcast, because I knew I couldn't do any of the, I knew I wouldn't be able to do any of the technical stuff. So that was my major thought, was how do I avoid doing the technical stuff and do this thing? So I went to them and they said, yeah, fine, do it. So then I just sort of put the word out there going, oh, I want to interview people from Doctor Who. And I got in touch with a few people that I knew who'd been in Doctor Who. And then a few people sort of said, oh, I know so-and-so who was in one episode. And I thought, oh, well, that person's never been interviewed before. And somebody went, oh, I know Kevin McNally, who's the guy from Pirates of the Caribbean, but was in four bad episodes of Doctor Who, but one of our finest actors. And I got in touch with Kevin, and Kevin was great, and I met up with him. And he was so funny, and he was so, but also so enthused about talking about Doctor Who, even though he was in a bad one. And he's Kevin McNally, who's done everything. And he was so nice, and he treated me like a normal person, not like some fan. And I think it's because you forget, you go, well, I am a fan, but I'm an actor, and I've been to the, you know, somebody had said, oh, it's this guy, Toby, he's been, and my CV obviously looks okay, you know. And I came away from that thinking, this is the best stuff. And I didn't just talk to him about Doctor Who, because I couldn't, that would be wrong, to go to Kevin McNally. He's been an I, Claudius, for goodness sake. He deep fat fried Lisa Faulkner in Spooks, and I'm just there going, tell me about the Twin Dilemma. You know, he's worked with Johnny Depp. So I asked him about everything. And it was brilliant. And I thought, this is what I do. I use Doctor Who as a conduit to talk to people, actors, boom operators, directors, designers, about their careers as a whole. I put the word out there and I said, do you want it to be just about Doctor Who, or a short podcast about Doctor Who or a longer one about everything. And I got a 50-50 response. Some people going, it should just be about Doctor Who. Some people going, oh no, it would be better if we talked about everything. Notice how I gave the first lot a stupid voice to undermine them because it's my anecdote. And I thought, well, actually, this is my podcast. I'm doing it. I'm not making any money. The only money that is made is that the interviewee afterwards nominates a charity and the people who download it, if they choose to, donate to that charity. And I hope people do. I know they do because I've had word back from the charities on occasion. And I thought, well, this is my thing and I'm doing it, it's costing me, I have to buy the actors lunch or whatever, I'll do what I want to do, which is do this thing where I talk to them about that. And I did it. I spent the whole of 2013, I got a first-hand anecdote from every single Doctor Who story. I interviewed everyone from Zoe Wanamaker to Kevin McNally via Bob Mills, who was an extra in one story in 1982, to eventually Russell T Davies came to my flat and gave me a day. So from really famous people, but not sort of regulars from Doctor Who, because they've been interviewed millions of times before. I'd done loads of DVD commentaries from 1960 stories, and if we'd had all of the cast bar one on that, I tried to get the one that we hadn't got for the podcast, just as a personal challenge. And so I got a few like that. And I got also, and all the best stories were nothing to do with Doctor Who. I got one about a guy who stayed on Errol Flynn's yacht in Saint-Tropez and saw him play chopsticks with his cock on a piano. This same guy had just lost 10 million quid because he's had to sell the nudist island that he'd bought because it was contaminated with nuclear waste. Do you know, this is more interesting than saying, I did rep and then I was in Doctor Who for four episodes in 1966, you know. And I found another inspiring stories from people who'd, you know, had cancer and survived it. Another about a guy who was an actor, but he was born in France, and at five days old his parents took him to England, forgot to sign a bit of paperwork. He went back to France as a 19-year-old and signed into a hotel and had to fill in the paperwork, and at midnight his doors were kicked in. He was arrested and court-martialed for desertion because his father had not signed a particular piece of paper, conscripted into the French army without speaking a word of French, and ended up serving in Algiers. And then whilst he's there, he's liaison to the British Navy when they pull into port because he can speak English, and they go, why is your English so good? He tells them the story. They invite him back onto the boat to look round, and his French officer says, you can go on the boat, but I want your word as an English gentleman that you'll not desert us. He goes onto the boat, they show him round, the captain summons him, says, you're on English soil now, mate. We set sail at midnight, come home. He said, I'm sorry, sir, I gave my word as an English gentleman that I would not desert, and he went back to his unit. These sorts of things, and this was a guy from one episode in 1969. All this sort of stuff is brilliant, and it's all because of my stupid obsession with Doctor Who, but it's always really been about the people. And so it's about people, and I've interviewed 250 different people. I've carried on doing it since 2013. It's another of those things I look back on now and go, if I wouldn't start that now. Same as I wouldn't start a comedy club now. I wouldn't start that now. I don't know why I started it then. I was drunk and sad, I think. Maybe that's the thing to do, be drunk and sad, and you'll do wonders.
There's a lot of people who are drunk and sad listening to this, so... You're about to basically launch a lot of podcasts that obsess about TV shows with that kind of comment. So, but you said this was like the turning point in your career. Like you said, this was a big...
No, that was the podcast, wasn't it? No, the podcast has just been a thing that I've done that I'm proud of. The turning point in my career was when I went to the Edinburgh Fringe in 2006 with a show called Moths Ate My Doctor Who Scarf, where for the first time, really, apart from... when Doctor Who came back in 2005... as a compere at a comedy club every Tuesday, you talk about what you know and what's happened to you. What I knew and what happened to me was that I was very excited about Doctor Who. And a beautiful moment happened where I would go and just do something about the episode. And when Doctor Who came back, it was very successful, having been a show that everyone thought was rubbish. So I was sort of right, in a way. And I remember the best moment was when I mentioned an episode of Doctor Who. And I said, did anyone see Doctor Who on Saturday? Excess malarkey. 200 people, absolutely crammed. And a voice from the back went, shoit! And the rest of the audience parted and guffawed, knowing that I would absolutely tear this bloke. And I love the fact that that was totally unsaid, but I'd done enough, and they knew and liked me enough, and what I did enough, to go, oh, don't diss Doctor Who in front of Toby. And I thought, oh, that's I can do. I can obviously talk about this in a fashion that's entertaining enough. And then it was a friend of mine's idea. He said, go to it. I'd got a title, Moths Ate My Doctor Who Scarf, because moths did eat my Doctor Who scarf. And it was a title that had been rattling around. And my mate said, do it as an Edinburgh show. And I'd never really thought about doing Edinburgh. Again, I never thought I was one of those comics that would be good enough. And I went to Edinburgh in 2006 and talked about what I knew. And I talked about what I loved, and also talked about what I knew and loved at a time that it was resurging in popularity. And I think I beat everybody, all the other comics to it, who quite like Doctor Who, by a year, because I don't quite like Doctor Who. I fucking love it. And so I was lucky. But I did a good show as well, and it wasn't a show about Doctor Who. It was a show about my dad leaving me with Doctor Who as a current running through it. This was before the dad shows, by the way. And so people came along expecting to see just a thing about a bloke going, oh, aren't I a geek? And it was much more human than that, I would say. But it was also funny. That got a radio series. That went to the West End. That toured for, well, I did the last performance of it in 2013. So I actually performed it quite regularly for the first three or four, but it still had legs, you know, 7 years after that. And I did a sequel that also performed at the Garrick Theatre in the West End. So talking about Doctor Who, doing what I know. But so that same friend who suggested I do it said, you're always funnier when you're you. And so, you know, those first years of trying to be Bill Hicks, trying to be Jack D, and trying to do all those people that I liked, rather than going, well, what do I find, what do I think's funny, what's the things that make me laugh that I do in everyday life. Finding my own voice was what was the turning point of my career. It helps comparing the same place every Tuesday night. Then I had 2006, so Excess had been going 8 or 9 years. So I didn't go to Edinburgh till I'd got quite good. I was in no hurry to go to Edinburgh. I'd done a group show many years before that, just to do Edinburgh. But I went to Edinburgh with my first hour when I was a comedian who could do an hour on stage.
I always wonder whether it comes down to the comedian not liking themselves enough to not imitate another person. Because if you're comfortable in yourself to be that on stage and off stage, it makes it easier to write for you.
Well, I'm not very comfortable with myself, but I know how to enunciate that in a way that's entertaining now.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, no.
Perhaps it's that uncomfortability, uncomfortableness, that is at the heart of what makes me funny.
I was going to ask why it was a turning point, but I think you've answered all those questions in a very short space of time. I'm going to do the final quick-fire questions. They're quick-fire for me, but you take as long as you like, although, as you said, there are people probably going to come in any second now.
By the way, can we give a shout-out to the people who've been sitting through this? You're doing it voluntarily, listeners. These people have just turned up for a gig, poor sods. Yes.
Sorry, okay. Thank you very much for
sitting. Aaron Dye, Monty Burns, Tony Kinsella, playing at a place near you soon. Go see them.
I'll link to them in the show notes and description. Thank you very much for putting up with this. Okay, so if we start with what are the best books on comedy writing or stand-up you've ever read?
God, you say it like I give a fuck about what anybody else thinks. The best books on comedy writing or stand-up that I've ever read? I haven't read any.
Okay.
Went to the University of Life, me, mate.
Fair enough.
I went to the Comedy Book of Life.
What's the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
Oh, I haven't overcome the fact that whenever there's anybody really important in the room, I somehow either find myself being a bit of a prick or very unimpressive.
Okay. What do you think is the biggest misconception people have about what you do?
That everything I seem to have done that's been a success is some sort of accident and that I'm just this nice bloke who muddles along.
Haven't you said during that you didn't have a plan and that you didn't necessarily want to do? So wouldn't it have been...
Yeah, but okay, all right.
So from an outsider point of view, wouldn't that be...
So what's the question?
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions people have of what you do?
Biggest misconceptions that they have about what to do. I don't really know because I don't really know what other people think about me.
Should we ask?
What's the biggest misconceptions that people have? What to do? Well, I think the misconception that people have is that I'm posh and I'm from some sort of privileged background because I'm not. I just over-enunciate my RP because at heart I'm a hammy old actor.
Fair enough. Who do you think is the most underrated person in the industry?
Well, we'll start by saying anybody over the age of 35, because they don't put them on telly anymore. A prime example of whom would be somebody I was working with the other day who did a whole new set, all of which was blisteringly good. And I was slightly disappointed because the last time I'd seen him, he'd done a load of stuff that I was looking forward to seeing again. You know, sometimes an act does a routine, you go, oh, they're going to do that routine tonight. And they didn't do that routine. They did another 20 minutes. It was absolutely brilliant. So this week, it's Jeff Innocent. But it is Jeff Innocent and people of his ilk, people who've been around a long time, who've just got so much good, so good, they wear it so lightly, they make it look easy, and yet they're not put on television because they're a bit older. Bonkers. Brilliant comic. If you make a TV show that wants to make people laugh and you don't put Jeff Innocent on it, you're a dick.
My next question was going to be, what do you think is the biggest problem in the comedy industry and how would you go about solving it? But I'm imagining it's people over 35.
No, it's not. No, no. The biggest problem in the comedy industry, and this is something I'm very firm on, I don't agree with a lot of what Andrew Lawrence says, and I'm not sure I believe his motives for saying them. But the fact that the problem with the comedy industry, and it actually doesn't affect the punters particularly, it doesn't affect the people that watch the television, so we must remember that, they don't care. But I believe in the BBC and a public service broadcaster, I don't think should only cast its net as wide as two or three agencies for the talent that they haul in. They should have people going out and looking at people. I mean, I know people who've made television programmes and they've said, right, who do you want for your, you know, your supporting cast? And these people said, this person, that person. They've gone, no. Actually, we're going to go for, we want this person, that person. And they've said, but can they act? And they go, we don't know, but they're on the list of people that we want to use. If you've got a list of people, I mean, Doctor Who's 50th anniversary, they had loads of Talking Heads programmes with comedians on. I wasn't on any of them. So let's just bring this back to me for a second, because that will happen with all sorts of programmes over everywhere. If you don't get me, who's been to the West End twice, has done a Sony nominated radio show about Doctor Who, and you're getting funny people to talk about Doctor Who. I write articles in Doctor Who magazine and The Guardian about Doctor Who. I think, doesn't mean you can't have everybody else, but if you don't ask me, because I'm not on your list, I even present a science fiction hour on the BBC, but because I'm not on the comedy people's list for whatever reason, that means when they're making a programme, they're not getting the most appropriate people. So let's now take this away from Doctor Who and about anything else. If you're making a programme about hairdressing and you've got a comedian who used to be a hairdresser and you don't put them on for their insight because you've got another comedian who's represented by the same agents that represent the big talent that you have on all of your other shows, you as a public service broadcaster are abdicating your responsibility to the license payers and actually to the creativity in the country, and you're doing exactly what the virtuous things that we've talked about the circuit doesn't do, which is get disparate voices. And I'm not talking about diversity now, because an agency can make up diversity very easily by plucking somebody from this ethnic group or this gender group or this haircut group or whatever. That's not what diversity is about. Diversity is because if they're all saying the same thing, it's not diversity. It's diversity of ideas, diversity of styles, and the comedy circuit is a rich mosaic of all sorts of very different people, and it's a very egalitarian one actually, because if you make an audience laugh, you do well. But that is then filtered through the prism of a corporate nature in order to be put on the television. In the commercial sphere, that is perfectly acceptable. It's all about making money. The BBC should not be doing that, and it should be reflecting that by actually having people who it employs a lot of people who go out and select people. The circuit on television bears almost no resemblance anymore to the live circuit, because you see people on television. I remember an act being on Have I Got News For You, because who they were was pertinent to a particular news story at the time, and I'd been booking Excess for ages at this point, and this act was on, and my other half at the time went, who's that then? I said, I've never heard of that comedian. Turns out that comedian was pretty much an open spot, who had graduated to Have I Got News For You by a series of demographic boxes that they ticked, and they weren't very good on it. And you sort of go, so what's the circuit for? What is all the hard work that people do to become a comedian worth? If actually that graduation doesn't then propel you onto television, there's a whole different set of rules. Again, nobody said that it was going to be fair. And again, I understand in a commercial environment, I actually just wish that the BBC would allow, because it used to be that producers would choose and different producers would use different people. Now all gets filtered up to a level of executives who want the same pool of talent to be chosen from. So what's wrong with the circuit is the monopoly that is held by a few agencies who are looking at making money and do great stuff for their acts and put good acts on. I'm not saying that most people on telly aren't good, but there could be more diversity. You don't have to see the same people on the same three programmes on telly that week. You could have three people in those three different spots, three different voices, three different sets of jokes on the same subject. And I just think, and I'm not a lazy, I think I'm a lazy, but I resent people who get paid a lot of money at an executive level being that lazy, and also lining the pockets of agencies who are not there to do anything that nourishes the circuit. They're almost like vampires on the circuit who sort of come and suck the good stuff out of it whilst when other people have done the hard work. So that.
I was going to ask you, because the last question normally is, if you had one bit of advice for someone starting their career now, what would it be? Do you want to answer that, or do you want me to end it on that one?
Gig as often as you can. Find your own voice. Speak in it for long enough. Don't get distracted by anything else. 21 years later, you might be a bitter old cunt in the bottom of the comedy store, but, you know, at least you won't be working in an office.
That was Toby! I love talking to him about the Manchester scene, and after hearing about how the gigs are better paid up in Manchester than they are in London, it's really given me food for thought about whether I should stay in London, where, if I'm honest, I've hit a bit of a wall in terms of progression. Also, his words about finding his voice and a creative outlet when he was depressed and his marriage was falling apart, I found really touching and inspiring, and I really was humbled that he would share that with us so openly and so readily. So, if you found any value out of this, or you found any comfort in what he said, please do thank him, and all the links to his social media accounts are in the show notes / on my website, which is simonkane.co.uk. This podcast is part of my ongoing quest to talk to more promoters outside of London, because, as we all know, the circuit is bigger than London, and as much as the industry tends towards the fact that London is the hub for everything, I think it's better that we cover more than just London, and respect the circuit as the wider and more diverse scene that it is. Speaking of tomorrow, the 18th of February 2017, I will be doing a live Q&A panel with four promoters from the Midlands at the Leicester Comedy Festival in Pat's Pizzeria. Entry is free, so if you could come down to that and support me, please do. You can find all the details in the show notes and on my website and on the Leicester Comedy Festival website. Also, if you're still around on the 19th of February 2017, you can come watch my Work in Progress show at The Exchange at 9 p.m. again at the Leicester Comedy Festival. Both shows are free / pay what you want on the way out. I'm really excited about this one. I had a really lovely time last year doing my show, and I'm hoping for great things. My fingers are crossed. If you can support me in either of those things, please do. If you can't make either of those things, but you know someone that can, please tell them about it, because every little bit helps. And last year, I advertised the Q&A just through the podcast, and we had about 40 people that came down, which is amazing. So if we can top that, I'd be massively happy and impressed. But any way you can show support for this podcast would be great. So if you can't come down physically, please do consider sharing the link for this episode to someone you think might value it. If you're new here, please hit that subscribe button. If you're old here, please do consider giving us an honest review in iTunes. And either way, please join the Facebook group, which is called Ask the Industry Podcast. And it's on Facebook, obviously. That's the best place to be able to ask all the future guest questions that you want to know, as well as find out who's coming on and any live events that we have coming up. You can also give me a donation towards the running costs of this show on my website, either via PayPal as a one-off donation or via Patreon as an ongoing donation. Every little bit helps, and I can't thank you enough for everything you do. But for now, I'm going to try. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for sharing the link. And thank you very much for donating if you do. And I'll see you all in about 15 days' time. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.